Hopefully we are going out live. Just double checking a couple things. So we are getting started a few minutes late today. Encountered a sort of last minute technical problem here. So just wanting to check and make sure that we are good. Sometimes there's a delay. So on these live streaming deals, guys, sometimes it takes it nearly a minute to show up at the locations that you're sending the signal to. So just trying to make sure we're good. All right, we are live. All right. So everybody should have in front of you a set of notes for lesson 121, The Great Bible, Assessing Its Origin, Impetus, and Production. So this is going to be the first lesson that we're actually going to start looking now with the Great Bible. We spent, what, three on the Matthew's Bible. And to get rolling, we're going to move ahead now by looking at the next Bible, which is the Great Bible. If you're watching this online, you can access the notes for this on the church's website. If you go to gracelifebiblechurch.com and click on, there should be an entry there right under recent sermons for today's lesson, lesson 121, The Great Bible, Assessing Its Origins and Impact. And if somebody is following with us here on YouTube or Facebook, if you could copy the link to those notes into those platforms, that would be helpful. This is a picture, this is the frontispiece, the title page of the Great Bible. There's a lot going on here, a lot of very interesting and significant things as far as the history of the English Bible is concerned that we're going to be talking about here over the next number of weeks as we look at this particular Bible. So let's get started then with the introduction there. Lesson 121, The Great Bible, Assessing Its Origin, Impetus, and Production, Introduction. The last three lessons have been devoted to studying John Rogers and the Matthew's Bible. In doing so, we have covered the following points. We looked at the Matthew's Bible, the complete work of William Tyndale. We looked at that in lesson 118. The Matthew's Bible, the first licensed English Bible. We looked at that in lesson 119. And then last Sunday, we looked at the Matthew's Bible, assessing the scholarship of John Rogers in lesson 120. Today in lesson 121, we want to conclude our discussion of John Rogers by looking at begin looking at the origin and impetus for the Great Bible. So the first point here is the death of John Rogers. So there's some information about him that I wanted to cover, but it's not long enough to devote an entire lesson to. So we're going to finish up our discussion of John Rogers and the Matthew's Bible in this one point, and then we're going to get into looking at the Great Bible in this lesson. So the point I want to look at right now is the death of John Rogers. I mentioned to you earlier in a previous lesson some things about his death, but we want to look at some details. In lesson 118, we noted that John Rogers was the first person to be executed by Queen Mary, otherwise known as Bloody Mary, in 1555 when she assumed the English throne. Recall that Rogers had fled England for Antwerp in 1534, where he met William Tyndale. After 6 years in Antwerp, Rogers left Belgium for Germany, where he met Philip Melanchthon. Now, Philip Melanchthon was the right-hand man of Luther, so he is a very important scholar within the history of the Reformation, and served as a pastor of a Lutheran congregation before returning to England in 1548. Recall these words from the pen of Professor David Daniel. He said, quote, Rogers remained in Meldorf, so that's in Germany, for 4.5 years until the spring of 1548. In January of 1547, Edward VI came to the English throne, and Rogers set about returning home. So Edward VI is the only male son of Henry VIII. So if you know your world history, you'll remember that Henry VIII wanted the Pope to annul his marriage because his first wife gave him a daughter, and they didn't know anything about, obviously, the biology of all this and the fact that it's actually the male that determines the sex of the baby. But so he's, you know, blaming his wife, and he wants the Pope to, you know, annul the marriage. The Pope refuses to annul it. So he has this whole series of wives and has all these kids with these different women that he married. Probably had a bunch of illegitimate kids too, but we won't get into all that. So Edward is the only male son, the only male offspring of Henry VIII. So he comes to the throne of England in 1547. Edward came to the English throne, and Roger set about returning home. He left Meldorf to the evident grief of his people, probably in the spring of 1548. By August, he was living in London in the house of the reforming merchant and publisher Edward Whitchurch. So we need a quote at the beginning of that, by the way, where it says, Rogers remained. So he's an exile. Much like William Tyndale, he leaves England when conditions are not favorable to people that believes as he does about the Bible, about theology, right? He flees to Antwerp. He meets William Tyndale. He's going to then go to Germany for a number of years. He's going to serve as the pastor of a Lutheran church in Germany. When Edward gets the throne, when Edward ascends to the throne of England, he's going to deem it safe to go home. So he's going to go home in 1548. Okay? Regarding these years, Donald L. Brake adds, quote, returning to England in 1548, Rogers lectured at St. Paul's Cathedral while continuing his association with the printer Edward Whitchurch, another exile. He was placed under house arrest for seditious preaching in 1553 and burned at the stake in 1555, the first martyr under the reign of Bloody Mary. So he goes home in 1548. He continues to be a prominent figure in the English Reformation, and he is eventually arrested in 1553 for preaching that is viewed by the government as seditious. So it was probably, no doubt, in some way, shape, or form, preaching against the authorities, the king, and I don't know all the details of exactly what he was preaching that got him into trouble. But he's arrested in 1553, and then he is burned at the stake in 1555 by Mary. Brake goes on to give the following account of Roger's execution. Quote, freed from the bonds of prison and its horrors, John Rogers was led to the stake. The bales of sticks, soon to be set ablaze, promise him the rewards of his faith. He had been delivered long ago from fear of death. Confident of the promise of the Master he had served for many years, he would soon meet his Savior. With a mocking in his voice, the sheriff bellowed, however you want to say that, will you recant of your abominable doctrine? Top page 2. That which I preached, I will seal with my blood, the worn, feeble voice replied. Then you are a heretic, shouted his captors. That shall be known at the day of judgment, Rogers confidently spoke, but now in a voice, no more than a whisper. Well, I will never pray for you, the sheriff threatened, but I will pray for you, came the same confident reply. They continued their path toward to the hideous goal, with Rogers quietly singing the Psalms. They were soon met by his wife and 11 children. Rogers showed no sorrow, but cheerfully and steadfastly walked to the stake, where he was burned to death in the presence of his family and a great number of onlookers giving praises and thanks. Truly a life well lived. It is estimated that Bloody Mary was responsible for 290 deaths during her reign. None was more impressive than how John Rogers faced his horrible death. So here's another example, guys, of a person associated with the English Bible, especially associated also with William Tyndale, who is willing to, you know, pay the ultimate cost and price, if you will, for getting the Bible into English and getting it out there for the people. So he is ultimately burnt as a heretic by the Roman Catholic Church, and he is not given the same courtesy, if you want to even view it as a courtesy, as Tyndale. Remember, they slit Tyndale's throat before they burned him. Not so with Rogers. They just burn him with his whole family standing there watching them do it. So before beginning my studies to teach these lessons, I knew very little about John Rogers or the Matthew's Bible. I now believe that the Matthew's Bible is perhaps the most important and overlooked Bible in the line of progression that culminated with the King James Bible in 1611. Rogers is responsible for propagating the Tyndalean translational tradition that would give birth to William Shakespeare and the generation of the King James translators. Rogers is extremely important in this story that we're studying here about the development of the English Bible. He is the one that put into print all of the available work of William Tyndall, which was then advanced forward in the next Bible we're going to begin looking at here very shortly, which is the Great Bible. So I think that Rogers needs a lot more of attention, and I think the Great Bible needs a lot more credit. I'm sorry, not the Great Bible. The Matthew's Bible deserves a lot more credit than it's been given. It's been wildly overlooked, and I think it's not fair to do that because I think it's absolutely essential in what would ultimately become the King James. So before we go to the next point and start talking about the Great Bible, does anybody have any comments, thoughts, questions, or anything you want to ask about Rogers?
How old was he when they killed him?
It's a great question, Ernie. The short answer is I don't know. He was not a young guy. He's married with 11 kids. Yeah, I'm assuming, you know, by the standards of the day, he was at least mid-life. You know, he's not a young guy when they, he was born around the year, well, no, we can do this. He was born somewhere between 1500 and 1505. And he's put to death in 1555. So he's somewhere between 50 and 55 years old. So, and I think by the standards of the day then, that was probably, you know, considered fairly old back in the early 1500s. Anybody else with a question or a comment? Okay, if not, then let's get into and begin our conversation now about the Great Bible. So the next point is the Great Bible assessing its origin, impetus, and production. Brake describes the situation as it pertains to the English Bible as of 1537 gave way into 1538. He says, quote, by the end of 1537, England had two authorized Bibles. Now, I think I quoted Brake the way that he said that. I think he means more accurately stated licensed Bibles. Not necessarily authorized Bibles, because there is a difference that we'll get into. By the end of 1537, England had two authorized Bibles. Henry VIII and Vice General Cromwell encouraged the reading of the Bible, so we've already talked about that. Some preferred the Matthew's Bible, while others read the cheaper Quattro edition of Coverdale. As is often the case, there were those who felt the reading of the Bible should come from one approved standard Bible. The notes of the Matthew's Bible offended many. A Bible, some insisted, should be placed in every church where it could be chained and proclaimed to the people without the confusion of misleading notes. So let's talk about this, okay? So when we get to the year 1538, by the time we get to this point, the year before, in 1537, King Henry had licensed the Matthew's Bible, all right? But he was also going, so we got the Matthew's Bible, and this one was done in 1537, all right? But around the same time, he is also going to issue a license for the printing of the Coverdale Bible. Whoops. The Coverdale Bible. So, let me explain this to you. So that would be the 1535 Coverdale Bible. All right. Now, here's the point that you need to see about this. Both of these are licensed. He says here, Brake says authorized. I'm taking exception with the word authorized there, and you're saying licensed. Has the king allowed these to be printed? Yes. All right. So some people who are Bible reading in England, some are reading the Matthew's Bible, and some are reading which? The Coverdale Bible, right? So the Matthew's Bible includes the marginal notes that are against the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church, etc., right? So some people are going to not like the Matthew's Bible because of the marginal notes, and some people are going to prefer the Coverdale Bible, largely because it is much smaller and it is cheaper, right? So if money is an issue for your family or for you as a person living back here, you might go with a Coverdale Bible simply because it was considerably less expensive than the larger sized Matthew's Bible. You guys with me? So here's what's happening by the time we get to 1538. Are there factions emerging within England that are supporting one Bible over the other? Okay. This is a perceived problem because the thinking is that what we need is a standard Bible that everyone is reading and accepting to be the Word of God in English, if you will. Okay? Now, so that is going to then lead to a decision which is ultimately going to culminate now in 1539 with the Great Bible. So the authorities in the king's circle of influence are going to look at this and they're going to say, this isn't really very good that we have these two Bibles competing for the attention of people. We need one standard Bible that everyone will read, and so that everybody is on the same page. And so that is going to lead to the decision to ultimately do which Bible? The Great Bible. Now, there's a little bit of irony here that I do want you to sort of think about. In the 21st century, I think you would agree that one of the major problems Christendom faces is the fact that everybody has their own Bible. And we have lost the shared identity that we had when everyone agreed about what the Bible was. Okay, you with me? So when modern versions came on the scene and they started to compete with the King James Bible for the attention of Bible readers, particularly in the United States, right, eventually did we lose the idea of the common English Bible. That, to me, has been a major problem for American Christianity, that we've lost that. Now, we have other problems, too, don't get me wrong, but to me, that is a major fundamental issue that we're facing. So when they make the decision way back here in the late 1530s to do the Great Bible, they're trying to avoid that situation, and they want to have one standard what? One standard text that everybody reads from, so that everybody's on the same page, and they don't want it to have any what? Any marginal notes that are going to be divisive. They just want it to be the text. Are you following that? Any questions about that? So let's look at the next point, bottom of page 2. This is interesting to consider given the current situation with the English Bible. In the 21st century, when translations abound, they are applauded for their cultural relevance and ease of reading. It was not so in the early, I want to say late, that should say late. It was not so in the late 1530s when the English speaking world, that should say. This sentence needs some work, Sylvia. Not her fault, my fault. It was not so in the late 1530s when the English-speaking world was first granted the opportunity to read the Bible without penalty following the king's licensing of the Matthew's Bible. At that time, people were calling for a standard text that everyone could read that would facilitate common understanding. As we will see later in this class, the same situation existed in the early 17th century when the King James Bible was translated. So if you fast forward from all of this to the year 1604, James is going to ascend the throne of England. Before this, he's been the King of Scotland for a fairly long time, for a number of years. In 1604, he is going to ascend the throne of Scotland, right? And when he does, this throne of England. When he does, he's inheriting a situation where there are two Bibles, the Bishop's Bible and the Geneva Bible, that are vying for attention amongst the common person, amongst the clergy, etc. So the officials of the Church of England, which Bible do they read? The Bishop's Bible. the Puritan faction in England, which Bible do they read? The Geneva Bible. And so King James is ascending a throne in a situation where he has political division, right? Well, what's his answer to this? His answer to that is to do another what? To do another Bible, the AV, so that there will be one standard what? One standard text. So he takes guys from this group and guys from this group, and he puts them into translation committees with the goal of putting a new Bible out, right? So that there would be a standard text here and not two different groups with two different factions. Well, that's the same thing that King Henry VIII and his guys want to do here, because in the 1530s, there's a division between those who want to use the Matthew's Bible and those who want to use what?
Coverdale.
All right. Any questions about that? Now, when we get here to this conversation, I got a lot to say about this, about the details of this, about what's going on back here in 1604 when King James decides to, you know, give his blessing to a new translation of the Bible, okay? So, but for now, we're still back in the 1530s. But I want you to know that there's a comparison issue here. What happened in the late 1530s is going to happen again similarly in the early part of the 1600s, which is going to ultimately culminate in what we now know as the King James Bible. You guys with that? Okay. So, top page 3. In the late 1530s, it was Cromwell who stepped forward to argue for one standard text. Quote, Cromwell stepped forward to support a standardized text that would be more acceptable to the bishops and clergy. They were also concerned about the variety of translations and accompanying notes that could be confusing or misleading. Cromwell chose Miles Coverdale, a proven friend of the court, to undertake the new translation. So, who's going to be responsible for this great Bible? It's going to be our friend who?
Coverdale.
Okay? Next point. Regarding these actions on the part of Cromwell, Dr. David Daniel states the following in his book, The Bible in English, Its History and Influence. He says, quote, Cromwell solved the problem of the objectionable marginal notes, is the problem that he's talking about in the context, by initiating, with Cramer's encouragement, a revision of the Matthew's Bible. It was to be a very large and unmissable folio in every church, prominent and easy to read, either along or to a crowd, either I should say alone, either alone or to a crowd. Grafton and Whitchurch were to publish it. The printing was to be done on the presses of Francisco Reginald in Paris, superior to any in England. So they're going to do this in Paris because the Paris printing techniques were considered to be superior to the technology that the English were using at this time. Okay, so they're going to do this job initially in Paris. The revision of the text would be minimal, but most of the marginal notes would be removed, partly because they did not belong in a volume intended to be read aloud in church, and not only during services, but partly also because Cromwell, to succeed, needed to keep hostility low. Conservative bishops were perpetually suspicious of reformers' annotations, though easy investigation shows that almost all of them are simple exposition or explanation. So here's what happens, okay? The Great Bible, Coverdale is going to be the reviser for the Great Bible, and the volume that they're going to revise is which one?
Matthew's.
Which one had two-thirds Tyndale?
Matthew's.
So as Coverdale revises the Matthew's Bible, he's going to move forward into history a text that is two-thirds who? Tyndale. You guys following that? Okay? That's why I'm telling you that this Matthew's Bible here is so important. Because this Bible, the king is going to authorize. Not license, but authorize. In fact, if you look at this picture here, who do you think this is, front and center, sitting on a throne?
Jesus.
This is King Henry VIII. What's he doing? He's handing the Bible out to his bishops. This is the title page of the Great Bible. Okay? So that's what's going on here. Coverdale is going to revise the Matthew's Bible, and that's going to become the Great Bible. So the Matthew's Bible, as we already know, was two-thirds Tyndale, which means when he moves this thing forward, the Great Bible is going to be two-thirds who? Tyndale. You guys following this? Okay. As mentioned above by Dr. Brake, the task of revising the Matthew's Bible fell to Miles Coverdale. Quote, "The revising was to be done by Miles Coverdale. This was an inspired choice. True, he lacked Hebrew and Greek, but two-thirds of Matthew's was Tyndale, who was reliable. Coverdale was obviously a good Latinist. Tweaking the Bible, especially the non-Tyndale half of the Old Testament, back towards a, quote, Latin original, would calm most reactionary critics, those who still maintained the Hebrew and Greek were subversive interlopers. However, Coverdale's skill with English spoken rhythms would ensure that the Bible in English sounded well in stone churches." Now, you think that's a weird thing, right? But they're going to ultimately be reading this thing how? Out loud. And they wanted it to what? Sound good, right? So this task now is going to fall to Coverdale. So as long as Coverdale doesn't mess up the Tyndale sections, are we going to be okay here? We're going to be pretty okay here, right? So you're basically going to advance this text with basically the objectional marginal notes removed. Everybody with me? The bulk of the work to produce the Great Bible was conducted in Paris, as it was believed that French paper and printing techniques were superior to anything England had to offer. Now, it's weird that, you might find it weird that nobody cared about that before this, but if the king is going to authorize this, does the king want, like, the best he can get? You know, that's just the way kings are, right? So the bulk of the work to produce the Great Bible was conducted in Paris, as it was believed that French paper and printing techniques were superior to anything England had to offer. Once again, Dr. Daniel offers the most thorough treatment of the subject matter. Quote, "Coverdale went to Paris. Work began. In May 1538, printing was started. Coverdale and the English overseers at the press reported that they were pleased with the progress. On 23 June, they sent Cromwell some finished sheets with an explanation of the principles of translation and editing being used. Richard Grafton, who was there, then complained to Cromwell of the inhibiting and hostile interference of the English ambassador to France." So now there is a English political figure who is getting in the way of the process. This was the Bishop of Winchester, Stephen Gardiner. No less a man always hostile to reform, as it showed itself in the English Bible. Grafton also reported that the costs were overrunning provision. Cromwell sent 600 marks of his own. He convinced the king to recall Gardiner. Bonner was nominated Bishop of London and the new ambassador. He was encouraging and kept Cromwell informed of the good progress of the great project. On 12 September 1538, Grafton and Coverdale wrote to Cromwell that the work should soon be finished. The English community in Paris under Cromwell was showing solidarity. Cromwell issued his famous second injunctions requiring that a Bible of the largest volume be set up in every parish church by Christmas, 1538. So, track with that. They write to him and update him in September 1538. Cromwell is now going to say, no, we're going to be able to meet this goal and have one of these Bibles in every church by Christmas 1538. Okay, now I know what you're all thinking. Well, why did you say it was 1539? Do you think it's just going to be this easy, right? Okay, no. So confident was Cromwell that in his manuscript draft, he altered Christmas to All Saints Day, 30th of November, bringing forward the requirement by a month. Then things began to go seriously wrong. In Paris, one of the English team was accused of heresy. Bonner reported that some of the English bishops were working with the French court to halt the printing. So, that would be conservative bishops in England that favored the Catholic party are trying to now intervene through the French, who are Catholic, to stop the printing. You guys following that? Okay. In London, the king altered the terms of the royal warrant favorably. The cause of what was obviously a harmonized attack on the English printing is not known. Coverdale wrote from Paris on 13 December 1538 that some of the 2,500 finished copies had been confiscated by the Inquisition. The work was stopped, and what had been printed was seized for burning. Grafton reported, not only the same Bible beginning, and so that would be the number, was seized and made confiscate, but also the printer, merchants, and correctors with great jeopardy of their lives escaped. So they are now going to fall under the hardship of the French Catholic Inquisition, who are trying to shut this project down. All right. Grafton and Whitchurch, with other members of the English team, fled to London. There seems to have been direct pressure from the French Inquisitor General from the Vatican. So is the Pope intervening to stop this English Bible in France because he has control of France? So here's, to me, is no doubt what happens. Do bishops in England send word that this is happening in Paris? This alerts the French authorities, this alerts the Vatican, the Inquisition is sicked on these guys, and basically they shut the whole thing down, and these guys have to basically flee back to England for their life as part of what's going on here. So they fled to London. There seems to have been direct pressure on the French Inquisitor General from the Vatican, whence came on 24 December 1538 a papal instruction that Bibles completely translated into English were either to be burned or prevented from being printed. The policies were intricate. The cause might have been purely a conservative attempt in Catholic Europe to halt reform, nor even a desire by the part of English bishops to thwart Cromwell. So there's no doubt. So here's what you need to take from that. Do these guys have to shut this thing down and flee for their lives in 1538 because now the Catholic Inquisition is after them in France? So this could have come about because of the English bishops who don't want to see this project happen, and or from people within the continent who still favor Catholicism and don't want the Bible in English in this manner. So, immediately on learning of the seizure of Bibles in Paris, as well as the flight of the English team, Cromwell met with the French ambassador in London, Castiglione. He, Cromwell, briefed the ambassador on the Bible project, mentioning his own investment of 600 marks in the undertaking, while broadly hinting that immediate delivery of the sheets might ease the way forward to the settlement of other matters then at issue between England and France. You have to see what's going on here, okay? Is the Bible at this time very much a political book? It very much is a political book, right? So now you have this political bargaining going back and forth between England and France, and they're basically saying, if you guys will agree to release these sheets of Bible printings, then we might be able to find our way to solutions and other things that are at issue between England and France at the time. Castiglione reported that the constable of France, who according to the imperial ambassador at the English court, Chappus, whatever his name is,
Close enough.
Had been the mover of the seizure of the Bible printing in the first place. Cromwell, meanwhile, in a letter from Bonner dated 1st of January, heard that Francis I had promised to return the books. In February, Bonner received from the constable his reluctant willingness to overlook the heresy and the bureaucratic errors, the royal license had been given on the wrong form. Yeah, that, isn't that just what the government does? You sign the wrong form, so we can't give you this, you know, we can't approve your cutting of the tree down or whatever. But here, it's the Bible. You didn't fill out the right form, but we're willing to overlook it. You can have your Bibles back. All right? And be rid of the type, printers, and even the paper, so the book could be completed in England. This willingness did not extend to what had been printed. So they're not going to release the sheets of printed text, but they'll give them the type and the press, and they'll give them all that back and make them start all over again. That's basically what that's about. Grafton and Whitchurch returned to Paris to look for the printed sheets. Fox tells a story that a corrupt French official had sold everything seized, four vats full of unbound printed sheets, for his own profit. The buyer was a Paris haberdasher who wanted them to lap hats in. Grafton and Whitchurch found the Inquisition had burned some of the bound copies, but not all the unbound. They returned to England with used paper, the type, the salvaged unbound Bible, and the French craftsmen. They rescued sheets. Those rescued sheets were of the Old Testament as far as Job, just over halfway through, and the New Testament as far as 1 Peter, 9/10 complete. Early in April 1539, fresh printing began in Grey Friars in London, then in Cromwell's hands. 3,000 copies of the Great Bible were ready, mixing the Paris and London printings by the end of April, and as stated at the end of the bound copy. So, the first edition from 1539 had in it pages printed in Paris that had been rescued from the Inquisition and completed with pages printed in London. You following that? Dr. Daniel reports that while 3,000 copies were finished by the end of April 1539, none were sold until November. Quote, Cromwell's hold on power was becoming slippery, but the delay seems more to have been because he was negotiating for the almost 2,500 sets of unbound copies still in the hands of the Inquisitor General. The exact details are not fully known, but Grafton went again to Paris in early November 1539, and the strong likelihood is that he came back with the balance of the Paris printing. Cromwell could not meet the demand created by the injunctions until he had the Paris copies in his control, nor could he risk repetition of failure to supply the parishes in 1536. With the copies shipped from France on top of the first Grey Friars printing, a second printing of 3,000 copies in March or April 1540, the great injunctions were filled. So does he succeed by the skin of his teeth to put a copy of the Bible in every parish church in England? Yes. Okay. Now I have here. So this is a website called archive.com or org. I can't remember which. Org. So here I have access. This is a 1540 Great Bible. I have tried to download the PDF of this three times and it fails every time, so I'm not sure why. But this is access to, so this is a 1540 Great Bible. So this is one of these second editions that was issued the following year in 1540 to fulfill the injunction to have a English Bible in every parish church. Now, obviously they didn't meet the deadline, but the reason they didn't meet the deadline is because of all this French interference. Okay? I know there's a lot of stuff to think about there, but does anybody have any questions about that? So, shortly after fulfilling his purpose of furnishing every parish church in England with a copy of the Bible in the vernacular tongue, Cromwell's political enemies moved against him to have him executed. Okay, so think about this. This is the guy who got Henry VIII to license the Matthew's Bible. Right? Now he's seeing this through to put up one of these great Bibles in every church in England. And now that he accomplishes his goal, he's going to be arrested and basically executed as a heretic. Alright, so let's look at this. Shortly after fulfilling his purpose of furnishing every parish church in England with a copy of the Bible in the vernacular tongue, Cromwell's political enemies moved against him to have him executed. Quote, Cromwell raised the peerage of the Earl, raised to the peerage of the Earl of Essex, yet even as he succeeded, his permanent enemies, the Duke of Norfolk and Stephen Gardiner, Bishop of Winchester, were moving against him in Parliament. The consideration of the Act for Uniformity in Opinion, the Six Articles, only weeks after his Bible began to be set up in parishes on 10 June 1540, the new Earl of Essex was arrested at the council table on charges of heresy and treason. The articles of his accusation were dominated by items charging him with introducing and maintaining dangerous heresies, including Lutheran and Anabaptist doctrines. The embarrassing failure of all that was left of his attempt to secure imperial or French allies against the papal bull of Henry's excommunication in the king's disastrous marriage to Anne of Cleves 6 months before, so that would be 6th of January 1540, had not helped, and now the royal eye had turned to Catherine Howard, niece of the Duke of Norfolk. So, Henry VIII now wants to marry the niece of the Duke of Norfolk. The Duke of Norfolk had been the opponent of Cromwell. So now who has to go? Cromwell has to go because of Cromwell. Cromwell's now in the way for what the king now wants to do. And that would be Mary, I think this would be wife number four at this point. Okay? You following all this? So who takes it literally? For this, Cromwell does. If you look at the next point, he was executed without trial on 28 July. Okay? So, I mean, I'm telling you, the story of the English Bible is a tale of blood, really. It really is. You look at what's happening with all these people. Now, look, I'm not suggesting for a second that, like, Cromwell is as pure as the driven snow or anything like that. But did he see a project to completion to put a Bible in every parish church? Okay? Any questions about that before we look at the last point? Okay. The Great Bible, what's in a name? The Great Bible gets its name from its size. That's it. The size of the volume. It's big, great Bible. From its size, as it was produced to fulfill Cromwell's injunction, which reads, quote, a proclamation ordered by the King's Majesty with the advice of his honorable council for the Bible of the largest and greatest volume to be had in every church. So obviously, well, if it's the Bible of the largest and greatest volume, let's just call it what? The Great Bible. What's that? It's not a pocket Bible. Okay? It was, but honestly, by the standards of today, it's not like overly huge as we're going to see here in a second. Regarding the size of the Great Bible, Professor Daniel states, quote, the popular name for this volume, the Great Bible, is perhaps justified by the page size of 337 by 235 millimeters, or roughly 14 by 16 inches. Sorry, 14 by 9 inches. Now, what's the size of a standard piece of paper? This is 8.5 by 11, right? So it definitely is bigger than this standard piece of paper, but it's not like huge. It's not like a ton bigger, right? So this dimension would be 8.5, right? Well, you only add another half inch to this, to the width of the page, And the height of the page would be 3 more inches. Right? 3 more inches? So, I mean, you got, you would have, it would be another half inch wider this way, but, and 3 inches taller this way. So, I mean, it's definitely bigger than what we would consider a standard piece of paper today, but it's not like, I have like coffee table books at my house that are like way bigger than that, as far as the page dimensions and so on. I have a world history atlas at home that I got that's probably like this high and like this, I mean, it's huge. It's massive. It's a cool book. I like to look at it and stuff, but like it's a lot bigger than the Great Bible. But by the standards of the day, was this a large book? So let's continue. Coverdale's Bible, Coverdale's 1535 Bible measures 278 by 186 millimeters, roughly 11 by 7 inches. So that would be what? That would be this height. That would be the same height, but it would be more narrow this way. Coverdale's Bible. So if you compare the size of that with the Great Bible, does the Great Bible appear huge? By the standards of the day, would that have been a huge book? Okay. But Matthew's 1537 Bible, which I had in here a couple different times over the last 3 weeks, was 302 by 215 millimeters, roughly 12 by 9 inches. So the Great Bible is only 2 inches taller than a Matthew's Bible, as far as the page dimensions. You following me? By comparing with some 19th century books, the book, though large, is not huge. Cromwell had ordered the setting up of the Bible of the largest volume, which certainly identifies it. The popular name may have come from this. And I'm going to say that's where the name came from. Calling it the Great Bible was simply a matter of just that it was the biggest one, and so they just called it the Great Bible, and then they would chain it into the churches, so you couldn't steal it. They'd have set up a lectern similar to this, and they would literally chain one of these in the parish church, and anybody that wanted to go in there could look at it, read it, etc. Okay? I think I get into that here in the next point. In addition to its physical size, Dr. Daniel identifies 3 other ways in which this volume was, quote, great. The Bible's distinction is threefold. First, it was the only Bible ever to be authorized in Britain. Notice the word authorized. Look at the parenthesis. The Bible that from the 18th century until recently was universally known as the authorized version, that of 1611, now more frequently known by its American name, the King James Version, was never authorized. It was never officially authorized by the king. The king approved of it, he set it up, but it never was officially authorized through a formal process. Passionate believers in its royal authority are soothed by the unlikely suggestion that a document of authorization has been lost. But we have no document on file that the king ever authorized the King James Bible. It's assumed to have been authorized because the king said, yes, let's do it, and then he turned it over to Archbishop Bancroft to oversee it. But he never officially authorized it. This is a historical fact. So the only one that has ever been officially authorized is the Great Bible. Okay? Second, only 13 years after Tyndale's first and smuggled... After Tyndale's first and smuggled in 1526 English New Testament, it brought the English Bible to the people in a massive way. So remember I showed you, I brought in my 1526, and it's this little teeny thing that you could have just stashed somewhere and hid it away. So now we've gone from having to have Bibles that are contraband and hidden away to the massive monstrosity that's going to be chained to a lectern. Okay? So does that signify a different attitude emerging toward the Bible? You don't have to, you know, read it in hunkered and closed corners, you know, where nobody knows you got it. Now it's chained there in every parish, church. In most of the parishes, its arrival and contents must have been surprising. So this is something that you need to think about here, okay? We've talked now for a number of weeks. We've talked about the Tyndale Bible in 1526. We talked about the Tyndale Old Testament in 1530. We've talked about the Coverdale Bible from 1535, the Matthew's Bible from 1537. We've talked about all this stuff, and your mind tends to assume that everybody had access to all this stuff. That's largely not what? That's largely not true. The first access that the majority of the English people had to a Bible in their language was this great Bible. Because a ton of the Tyndale ones were burned, okay? These were not printed in large numbers, the Matthew's Bible and the Coverdale Bible. So while they were sold and people had them and they were out there, and if you had one, great. If you knew somebody that had one, even, you know, great. But most people still had not come into physical contact with a Bible in their language until these great Bibles are put in every parish church. So that's another reason why this Bible is significant. And again, oh, by the way, it's still two-thirds who?
Tyndale.
So, third, though Coverdale's revision was generally in a more Latin direction, the parishioners' encounter with the Bible was still with the greatness of Tyndale. Alright? So that's why I've said to you this Matthew's one is so important. Because this one is a revision of that one, and that one's two-thirds Tyndale. Okay? Brake records the following about the impact that the great Bible had upon the common Englishman. Quote, "How did the common person react to an authorized Bible available to all? Bishop Edmund Bonner set about to place the great Bible in every church in England. In the famous St. Paul's Cathedral of London, Bonner, at his own expense, changed six beautiful great Bibles to six pulpits. The Bibles were to be read in orderly fashion without disputations. Instead, however, people gathered around the Bible and began to act disorderly." Sounds kind of like Facebook. "Reading with irreverence and arguing its meaning." Now it really sounds like Facebook. "In order to prevent parishioners from reading the Bible during the services and to maintain order." So imagine you're having a church service and six dudes are standing at the lecterns arguing about the Bible. Right in the middle of when you're trying to have a what? A service. That's what was happening when they first have access to it. Okay? "So in order to prevent parishioners from reading the Bible during the services and to maintain order, Bonner placed on the front of each pulpit the infamous admonitions." So these are like Bible reading instructions. That's what these admonitions are. "The admonitions set certain rules for the use of the Bible. For instance, the Bible was to be read quietly, humbly, and charitably, without disturbance to others during services, and not drawing crowds to listen to the exposition of the text. A people who had been deprived the freedom to read the scriptures finally had a Bible to read, and they had difficulty doing so in an orderly fashion." Now, we think that sounds weird. But we all have the luxury of having a Bible in our lap every time we come to church. Our own one. And you probably have 50 more at home besides the one that you brought with you. Maybe 50, that might be going a little too far. You got 10 probably in your house, you know, plus your app, plus your computer, you know. In other words, the Bible's everywhere now, right? So have you ever seen these videos? I've seen videos on Facebook and social media where they show like Chinese people and the way they react the first time they see a Bible and they can own it. I mean, they like are stumbling over each other trying to get their own what? Their own Bible. All right. Well, that's kind of the same thing here, right? So imagine you've never seen a Bible in English and there's six of them chained in the church over there and you want to go what? You want to go read it. Well, now you got to get in line. Right? And then the guy standing there, he's going to tell you what he thinks it means. You can see how that might be a little disorderly, right? So that's what these admonitions are about, to instruct them about how to orderly read the Bible. So we're almost done. The Bible in the English vernacular was now approved to be read, creating a lasting thirst for Englishmen of all classes. Everyone was caught up in this new delight. They either read it themselves or had it read to them. Many began the process of learning to read just for the enjoyment of reading the Bible. So what's going to happen to literacy rates? They're going to explode, right? It is impossible to imagine the first reading of the Scriptures and the impression it made upon their hearts. Some supported the old school that argued if the common folk started reading the Bible on their own, it would lead inevitably to religious anarchy. The younger ones, no doubt, were burning with a zeal for spiritual freedom. And so is the beginning of our study here of this Bible, which is known in history as the Great Bible. Now, next Sunday, we are not going to have class. My wife and I are finally going to be able to get away for our 20th anniversary. So my dad will be in town next Sunday, and he will be preaching the main message, but there will not be Sunday school. Assuming that I have time to get a lesson done, my plan is to have class again 2 weeks from now. All right, but I am not going to be studying for this while we're on our trip. I'm just saying. I'm unplugging and not having anything to, I'll read my quiet time, but I'm not having anything to do with serious study for this time. It's been a long year, so.
Where are you going?
We're going to Gatlinburg area, and that's where we went for our honeymoon 20 years ago. So that's what we're up to, and there won't be any class next week. And assuming I get a lesson done, we'll do something. I don't know if it'll be the next lesson. Maybe we'll have a Q&A or we'll do something when I get back, which will be the 18th, I think. But I don't know if I'll have time to get all these notes together and stuff. We'll just have to see how it goes. All right? Any questions?
The difference again between licensed and authorized again?
It's a technicality in Old English law between if you're granting a license, you're just sort of allowing it and you're giving it permission. If you're authorizing it, you are saying that the king himself, as the head of the country and the Church of England, is totally completely behind this all the way. There's a, to you and I, it sounds like a should be the same thing, but based upon what was going on back then, there's an element of greater formalness and authority by having it be authorized than simply licensed. So the Matthew's Bible I showed you was printed with the king's most gracious license. So in other words, the king is not going to do anything to stop anyone, but he's also not necessarily doing what? He's also not necessarily promoting it and telling everybody they should what? Read it. So there is a difference between it being licensed and it being authorized.
Okay.
Okay? All right, we gotta quit though.